Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday, April 20th edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for Natural Resources. It's the subcommittee of the whole committee. We are hearing the Department of Environmental Quality budget bill, HB 5019. We are in the midst of agency presentations, and yesterday we got partly through the Water Quality Division overview. So we'll begin today where we left off yesterday with Mr. Mike Llewellyn, Division Administrator of the Water Quality Division, and Rick Gates from the Laboratory Division, who's the Administrator there, and the Director of the agency, Mr. Langdon Marsh. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
We got through four slides yesterday, or just seven.
So we rushed at the end.
And today we have session at
10:15,
so we'll need to 10 a.m., so we'll probably adjourn at probably 5:15. And we have some materials to distribute first thing.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to distribute three items from the department. A letter in response to some questions just that we had regarding enforcement. Responses to committee questions on waste management and cleanup, and responses from the Air Quality Division. So I'll provide those to members as the department begins the presentation.
Okay, and let's have the department begin its presentation. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Mike Llewellyn, Administrator of the Water Quality Division. Yesterday, we ended with a discussion of the threat to Oregon's water quality, and today I'd like to begin the discussion on the tools that DEQ brings to bear as we address water quality issues in Oregon. For over 25 years, DEQ has focused on reducing the amount of pollution coming out of pipes from industries and municipalities. Sometimes we take for granted how much progress has been made with point source pollution, as it's called, and it's good to realize that a lot has been accomplished. However, as Oregon grows both in population and the diversity of the number of industries and businesses that generate wastewater, it'll be very important that we continue to invest in the infrastructure necessary to deal with wastewater pollution, and also very importantly that we reinvest in the infrastructure that already exists so that we maintain progress in water quality related to point source management. DEQ is very involved in working with both businesses and municipalities in helping manage point source related pollution. This is a graph that is trying to give a perspective going back to the 1940s when we here in Oregon first began to seriously address pollution coming out of pipes. This graph shows just how far we've come since 1940. The levels of sewage treatment done by municipalities in particular, which is what this slide is about, has been improving steadily over the last 50 to 60 years. We've seen a consistent improvement in the treatment technology that's been brought to bear. In the early 1940s, as you can see on the left side of the graph, most municipal treatment plants simply provided what is known as primary wastewater treatment, which is, for all intents and purposes, just settling out the solid material in wastewater and then having whatever is left discharged directly to the stream. Now, treatment technology, as you can see as you move towards the right side of the graph, can remove over 90% of the organic and suspended material that's in wastewater, and this is known as secondary treatment. And in some cases, even additional treatment is provided depending on where that discharge is located, and that's known as advanced wastewater treatment. Some people also call it tertiary wastewater treatment. The point that I'd like to make on this graph is that even though the treatment technology or the efficiency of treatment technology has increased dramatically since the 1940s, the sheer volume of growth in terms of wastewater has obviously impacted Oregon streams. So even in a situation where the treatment technology cuts in half the amount of pollution that would come out of a treatment plant, if you double the flow to the treatment plant, you basically are sort of holding your own. So this is why it'll be very important that as we continue to grow, both with municipalities and industries, that and the treatment technologies improve, that we keep pace with the progress that's been made to date. I'd like to touch very briefly on the wastewater permitting or wastewater management program within CEQ. As I mentioned, Oregon actually has a very progressive tradition of dealing with wastewater that goes well back to the late 1930s, well before the Clean Water Act was adopted at a national level. And DEQ has been active in managing wastewater since its inception in the 70s. With regard to wastewater treatment, obviously you've heard about wastewater permitting. We require permits which include limits on the amount of wastewater that can be discharged to our surface or land system. We also provide technical or financial assistance to both industries and municipalities after a permit is issued to help that municipality or business deal with the requirements of the permit. We provide engineering review of treatment plans that are submitted to DEQ, although recently we've been disinvesting in the larger municipal treatment plan review because these folks have the capacity, the internal capacity, to obviously know what they're doing in terms of building the treatment plant, and we're trying to shift those resources that we had historically had reviewing plans for the larger municipalities to smaller municipalities and businesses because they're the folks that really need technical assistance because on plan review because in many situations they simply don't have the internal capacity or even a public works director in some of the smaller communities to even understand how to begin with this treatment planning process. So this is an area that we're moving away from the big municipalities to the smaller ones in terms of our resource commitment. We also conduct inspections, which are required, particularly under the Clean Water Act, to make sure that those treatment plants are meeting their permit limits. And oftentimes when we do these inspections, we also provide technical assistance when we go out to the facility because we're trying to focus on compliance and helping these facilities maintain the necessary conditions of operation so that they're meeting their permit limits. And obviously, we do monitor how these treatment facilities are doing. Actually, the facilities themselves provide their own reporting back to us, and we verify that they are indeed meeting the limits of their permit. And as a very last resort, in some situations, if there's continued problems and there's no resolution on a technical assistance basis, there are times where we do take enforcement action. One of the changes that we're instituting for the wastewater permit program is driven a lot by the themes of the Oregon plan. As many of you know, one of the management principles of the Oregon plan is to try to manage by watershed, with watershed councils. The TMDL program that we're dealing with is based on a watershed approach. And so we're moving our permit program also to a watershed basis. And by July of this year, we hope to have converted all of our permitting to a watershed approach. And let me just explain what that means. Currently, DEQ decides on an annual basis which permits we will be addressing, based primarily on the fact that each specific permit has an expiration date. Usually it's a five-year permit cycle that comes up, and then that permit needs to be reissued. As an example, a stream may have 10 different point sources on it, under the current system, and all of those permits may come up at different times over any period, such as 10 years. Beginning in July, we will be managing our permit program so that all permits come up for reissuance at the same cycle, at the same time. And we feel that there are several advantages to moving in this direction. First, it will provide much more certainty to the permittees as to when their permit is going to be reissued. Secondly, we believe that it is more effective at protecting water quality by making permit decisions in a watershed context rather than looking at a permit this year and the permit conditions that it needs and the next year coming in and dealing with another permit on the same water body. This way we're getting more leverage of our resources so that we're evaluating all of the permits in a watershed at the same time so that we're making equitable decisions as to who needs to do what in that watershed context rather than this individual approach. It also will provide much more efficiency in terms of our data collection, because rather than sending out our lab folks to look at just one facility in 1 year to collect the background data necessary to write that permit, our lab folks can now go out, evaluate the entire watershed, along with the watershed councils, and reinforcing the data collection on a watershed basis, so that our environmental decision making for those that set of permits that we're dealing with is done in a much more comprehensive manner. And finally, I think it'll help the public understand the wastewater permitting program much better, because rather than hearing about a permit that might be coming up this year in a watershed, and then they hear next year that a permit's once again being discussed by DEQ, we're bringing to the public all of the permits in that particular watershed at the same time. So what you see here is a map of the Northwest region, which is out of Portland, how they're going to be managing permits on a watershed basis in their area of the state beginning in July. And you can see by the color coding, as an example, that all of the permits in this North Coast region will come up for reissuance in the year 2000, and these other watersheds that are displayed here are done in the same manner. We'll be doing this statewide, and I think it'll be a much more efficient system, and it will reinforce the watershed theme of the Oregon Plan.
Sure. Senator Sarno.
Right, is there any connection between the permitting process you're talking about here and the CMDL?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, absolutely, and that's one of the reasons we're trying to do this. As an example, when the TMDL is done for a particular watershed, if point sources are required to do something, we need to then go back and reissue permits to meet those limits. And rather than doing that again on a permit-by-permit basis that's staggered over the next 5 or 6 years, we'll be able to do this all at once. It'll make much more sense to the public in terms of how the point sources are contributing to the TMDL implementation. With the growth of population and businesses that discharge wastewater in Oregon, DEQ has seen a dramatic increase in the number of facilities that we must address. As you can see, we are now responsible for administering over 3,500 wastewater permits here in Oregon. The biggest jump in the permits occurred roughly in 1996 with the new Federal Clean Water Act requirements to permit stormwater runoff from particular industries, construction sites over 5 acres in development, and large municipalities. Even without the new stormwater permit, however, facilities which need a permit to operate are increasing due to just growth in the state of Oregon, both in the municipal and industrial sector. When we go into the work sessions, we have a policy package that we'll be discussing related to our management of the wastewater program because of revenue shortfalls. Five of our existing positions that are in the wastewater program are at risk, so we'll be discussing that at the work session. I mentioned stormwater management in urban areas. DEQ has a responsibility to deal with stormwater for specific types of industries and municipalities under the Federal Clean Water Act. DEQ limits the amount and types of stormwater which may run off from these particular sites. As I mentioned, DEQ requires that developers and municipalities control stormwater runoff from construction sites currently for any land disturbance over 5 acres, and that industries manage their sites to assure that rainwater is not exposed to potential contamination. In many cases, some very common sense things can be done by simply taking hazardous material that might be out in an open yard and putting it under cover. Kind of straightforward stormwater management are the types of practices that are employed in the industrial stormwater program. These types of stormwater management provisions are often focused just during construction when you're having exposure of land as you're just developing a particular site. But we're also concerned about long-term stormwater management as well after the construction has been done. How do you manage stormwater in some of these areas? These are two photos of good stormwater management practices, which are relatively simple to employ. and again are quite often just common sense in terms of managing runoff and stormwater in urban areas. DEQ also manages the on-site waste permit program. I've been talking about municipal and industrial wastewater, which is discharged into surface water from pipes, essentially, or the stormwater runoff from particular construction or industrial activities. However, more than 1 million Oregonians rely on on-site sewage disposal systems. In 1997 alone, there were more than 5,000 on-site permits issued for new systems by DEQ in the state of Oregon. When properly sited, installed, and maintained, these on-site systems can help protect groundwater for present and future generations. On-site permitting activities are an important component in our efforts to prevent non-point source pollution and protect public health and drinking water. We'll also be discussing in the work sessions a policy package, again related to declining revenues for our current on-site system folks. One of the issues that we will be spending a lot more time on, we believe, in the next few years is that as alternative technologies begin to develop, we're getting a lot of requests from folks who are developing these technologies to approve them for use in Oregon. And this is another part of the policy package that we're going to need the resources to devote to those new technologies that are coming forward.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, relative to the septic tank system, what would be the pollutant that would be emitted by one of these systems, say one that's not functioning properly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, the two that I think are the most prevalent would be bacteria and nitrates.
Okay, now. Let's go back to the sewer treatment plant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, aren't bacteria and nitrates coming out of the sewer treatment plant?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, yes. Yes,
they do. Extremely large quantity.
Senator George, I'd have to give you some order of magnitude comparisons of what the raw wastewater is compared to what the ultimate discharge is. But in the case of a surface water discharge, both nitrogen compounds and bacteria must meet state water quality standards that are protective of either aquatic life and or public health.
But you literally could have a septic tank with absolutely a zero tolerance for any discharge, and a sewer treatment plant with a significant permit to pick up the same thing that would be zero coming out of the septic system.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I don't believe that any septic tank discharge after going through a drain field is still a zero discharge. I think that it's almost impossible to get zero nitrogen loadings or bacteria. But obviously a well-designed system is designed to try to minimize the amount of nitrates and or bacteria that would be discharged.
How would the nitrates and bacteria get out of that system if it didn't have a surface break?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, after the material, the wastewater goes into the septic tank and it goes into a drain field,
right,
and then it percolates through the soil, there still is a residual, particularly of nitrates. The septic tanks, although they do a pretty good job of treating nitrogen, ammonia, and nitrates as an example, they're still not a zero discharge facility any more than a wastewater treatment plant is. There's always going to be that residual.
Okay, other than maybe some scent, Mr. Sherman, if I could, so we get the bottom of this thing. If it wasn't anything other than sandy soil, the percolation rate from one of those things would be almost minimal, and most of the time you would find it relatively close to the surface where plants might actually pick it up the nitrates.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I think it really depends on, as you're mentioning, the location of these facilities, but they're designed, by their very nature, these facilities are designed to percolate the water after it's gone through the drain field. And again, you're still going to have some residual nitrogen levels in the wastewater coming out of these septic tanks.
Okay, back to the sewer treatment plant. If you remove 90% of the solids out of that plant, what happens to that 90% solids that are pulled off? Okay, is it going through?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, in most cases, the solids, which are now called, the term that is used is biosolids these days, or used to call sludge.
Right.
In a lot of cases, this material has been land applied. The federal regulations on biosolids are moving in the direction of trying to make them basically a valuable commodity, because once treated and put on land, they're actually a good fertilizer source. There's still, in some of the larger municipalities, problems obviously with metals, right, okay, or other chemical constituents that just aren't removed completely from the treatment process. But clearly the direction for biosolids management is to make it a product that can be safely used in a land application.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to get this primary design. when you take those solids, and we're going to do a land application, and I had one of these done on my property, one of the things I noticed was that the bacteria problem was still there. We were told to stay away from this crap, and so normally, is the bacterial problem present for a land application? In other words, we've moved the 90% of the material from the first treatment plant. Now it's in the form of sludge, and we're going to go out and we're going to deposit it on farmland or pasture land or something like that. All the heavy metals are there, a lot of the chemicals are still there, and we do have a bacterial problem. Is that the case? If we don't have the bacteria, you probably treat it with chlorine or something like that, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I think that is the case, that it's after treatment, it should be safe enough to land apply, but if I could have, I'll be glad to get back to you with some examples of what the characteristics of some of these sludges are in terms of bacteria levels.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get this back in perspective. You're talking about enormous quantities coming out of sewer treatment plant, because I see that, billions of gallons, and let's assume that, 90% of that, although maybe 90% solid wouldn't be that much. But the point of it is, once that land is fried, and you have rain, which is going to occur in Western Oregon, any of the heavy metals, the bacteria, is immediately going to be washed back to that stream, greatly exceeding anything that would happen with a septic tank.
That was my own personal experience. I'll never do it again because of what I observed.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I'm not familiar with that situation, but clearly when these communities land apply biosolids or septage, there are requirements in terms of making sure that that does not happen. It's not supposed to be applied in a manner that then would run off and then be self-defeating, essentially.
Yeah.
I'd be glad to discuss if there was a situation, because that should not have happened.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah,
I would just follow up. I can totally have to find anything that came off of my place, but I've observed other applications in which I know that it was going reaching straight to the train. Thank you.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair, and a little bit to Senator George, and maybe you could provide a little information on it too, the use, rather extensive use of the Portland biosolids or sludge, as it was called originally, on the Madsen farms in Unicelomaro County area. I think rather extensive utilization of that or recycling of that product, I think. Am I wrong that there's some period of time that needs to expire before that land can be used for food product, human food product? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I don't personally know, but I'll find out for you.
I think that would be maybe an interesting example for the committee here, because I know it's probably the largest single usage of that in the state of Oregon. I may be wrong on that, but I think that's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, for the record, I'm Rick Yates. In that land application on the Madison Ranch, it was applied in agronomic waste, and I believe you're absolutely correct. There is a time period by which they cannot put human food crops on that land. I don't know that exact number, but I'm sure we can find out for you.
I think it would be interesting for people.
Mr. Chairman, regarding the Madison Ranch, aren't they also using reclaimed water from the processing plants for that location?
Yes.
And that's why that also is going back on the fields?
Yes.
Is this my case?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Finished,
Mr. Jensen. Mr. Chair. Laying And you may have already touched on this in the committee, but the problem we had over in Jefferson County with the application of the biosolids to the one particular farm that was on the elevated surface above an individual's house, we had the extreme weather conditions, rain, and a great deal of that slid off into somebody's house, as I'm sure you're all aware. Was there any, what would I call it, inappropriate application by the farmer involved there? I mean, what happened there? Was that just an act of God? Couldn't have been anticipated, or what was the basic background for that and why that happened?
Mr. Chair, Representative Weston, I'm going to have to get those facts straight and get them back to you. I don't recall exactly what the problem was, except to know that there was a problem, and I don't know whether it was an accident or a mistake, and I'd like to get back to you on that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of charges and countercharges, and that the farmer involved did a double application more than the law allows, and farmers charging that, no, I did everything just right, and it was, you know, the excess rain that caused it to go off. And then I think DEQ got involved and said, you know, the slope of the land was too great, that the material was applied to. If you give me the department's, I don't want to say spin, I think the thing has settled down. I mean, and I would agree it's just let shitty dogs lie at this point in time. But, yeah, if you just give me something, either verbally or whatever, I'd appreciate it.
I'd be glad to.
Other programs that DEQ is involved in terms of helping with drinking water protection include several different approaches to groundwater management area planning and technical assistance with local governments. DEQ is working closely with the Oregon Health Division and Oregon municipalities to protect drinking water supplies by providing technical assistance as communities develop and implement drinking water protection plans. These plans that I'm discussing range in scope from just focusing on a groundwater wellhead area that a community may have to larger geographic plans for critical surface water supplies under what is called the Groundwater Management Area Statute. DEQ, as an example, is currently working with the city of Bandon to develop a plan to protect their drinking water source. The protection plan will be developed with the involvement of property owners and stakeholders within the watershed. Emphasis in Bandon is being placed on identifying areas where increased sedimentation is impacting the city's water supply and driving up their costs of treatment and storage because the reservoir is filling with sediment. And so this planning process with the city and folks in that watershed area is trying to help identify vulnerable areas that might lead to the contamination of the city's water supply and developing a plan that the city then can work with to help protect their water supplies in the future. DEQ is working with several municipalities across the state on this very similar type of drinking water protection, both for surface and groundwater. Representative Jensen, yesterday you asked me about the Umatilla groundwater management area, and I told you I'd talk a little bit more about that today. This is an example of a groundwater management area planning process that DEQ was involved in with local folks. The lower Umatilla Basin was declared a groundwater management area in 1990 because of high levels of nitrates had been detected in groundwater. The declaration led to additional studies of the problem and the development of a community-directed groundwater action planning process. Implementation of the action plan is now taking place, and it's based on a voluntary approach which uses, as examples, best management practices for folks involved in the agricultural community, looking at on-site system problems that also impact nitrate contamination. We're also working in the Malheur County area on a very similar groundwater management plan. In that area, some of the focus has been on alternative irrigation and fertilization practices,
The local Natural Resource Conservation Service folks and the Soil and Water Conservation District staff in those areas are heavily involved in working with farmers in particular on practices that can help minimize the impact of fertilizer application to groundwater. The concern, as I think I mentioned in my very first day, is that once groundwater is contaminated, it's extremely difficult to clean up. And so our focus in the groundwater area is very much on pollution prevention, to get folks understanding what can potentially contaminate groundwater supplies, and to help communities develop action strategies to prevent groundwater contamination before it occurs.
Yes. Okay.
What's the, in your best judgment, what's the original source of contamination in the Umatilla Basin here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I spoke with our Eastern Regional folks in Pendleton about that question, and according to them, it was quite a mix of different sources. It included confined animal feeding operations, fertilizer applications, leaking on-site systems. I think they're the top three. But one of the issues that was discussed when the plan was put together was to not finger point essentially among all these different sources, and to try to recognize that, you know, locally there were many different factors that were potentially impacting nitrate levels.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Jensen,
from the looks of your map, it looks to me like you've picked the city of Hermiston here to. Give the worst case, where the worst case scenario is at. Is that reasonably accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think that map in terms of the nitrate contamination probably reflects where we have monitoring, actual monitoring data, and that was probably the on-site system situation in terms of that cluster of the nitrate contamination.
One of the, of course, in that immediate area is a lot of animal feeding. One of the principal issues in recent years has been the C&D livestock, which is just a mile or less as the crow flies from the city itself. And it seemed that as I looked at that originally, there was some guilt on the part of C&D for excessive contamination. Are we carefully monitoring that now, or is that Department of Agriculture that is going to be doing that today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, it is the Department of Agriculture that's involved in, they actually issue the wastewater permits for confined animal feeding operations. And I spoke with Lorna Young at Agriculture, and she assured me that they have I'm not sure if it's an order or an actual permit that's now required of that facility to deal with lining of the lagoons that store the manure as well, which was one of the problems with it, some of the nitrate contamination.
Senator Jurek, are you finished?
I think so. There's a lot of places we can go with that, but we don't need to spend the time on.
Okay.
Yeah, let's have breakfast.
Senator Jurek, fascinating subject. We have a certain level of nitrate problem with groundwater in the Umatilla area. So one of the things that's intrigued me, and I think it has my colleagues too, my work here, is the idea that, for example, in the Willamette, okay, we know that, we just talked about a little while ago, all these nitrates being discharged from the sewer treatment plant, possibly ag runoff or forestry or whatever, and it's now in the Willamette River, and it gets down to Wilsonville. We're going to pump that nitrate-laden water, and we're going to claim we're going to clean it up. How do you do that? And if you could do that at Wilsonville, why couldn't you do it at Umatilla?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, when water is taken out of a surface water supply for drinking water and then conveyed, the water purveyor then distributes it to homeowners, under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, they have to treat that water supply, whether it comes from groundwater or surface water, to meet various health standards. So in a situation where you have groundwater or surface water that already has nitrate levels in it, including nitrate levels that are above the drinking water criterion of 10 milligrams per liter, that cannot be distributed to a consumer until it's treated. So most municipalities have to build basically a water treatment facility prior to conveying it. So again, whether it's contaminated groundwater that then is going to a homeowner, or it's coming out of a stream like the Willamette, it still would require treatment prior to distribution.
What is the process? We'll call it, Mr. Chairman. What is the process of removing the nitrate from the water?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the only process that I'm aware of is using specific ion resins to absorb the nitrate on. And I should add that most public water supplies are not dealing with water that has nitrate in the exceeding the 10 part per million level. Even in the Willamette River, though nitrates are being discharged to the river, nitrate levels are orders of magnitude below that, well below it. Once they get discharged into the river or entering the river has a natural system in which phytoplankton and aquatic plants along the river can start utilizing the nitrates, and it sort of self-cleans itself to an extent. It's only when it greatly exceeds its ability to deal with the nitrates that we start running into nitrate and one of the problems in the river.
Could I ask one follow-up question? Let's say we're in late August and it hasn't been raining for several months, and you're at Wilsonville and you're going to pump out of that river. All of these things would have been occurring, but you would have limited mixing flows in, and you would have had substantial discharges from the city. People are fertilizing their yard, or the sewer treatment plants are running the exact same volumes, maybe higher. What would be the ratio between what you would expect to be in that water at Wilsonville and what you would expect to be in that water coming out of those wells at Umatilla? How big of an area is actually affected at Umatilla? Did you go 2 miles outside of Umatilla and find clean water, or has it basically penetrated quite a basin of water? And how would those levels of nitrate compare between that scenario of late August in the Willamette at Wilsonville and Umatilla?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not sure I can totally answer that question. I know from monitoring results in the Willamette, we are still seeing nitrate levels, even in late fall and dry years, that are 2 and 3 orders of magnitude below the drinking water nitrate standard. As far as where they would go in the Umatilla Basin to get cleaner water, I'm not sure I can answer that.
How would they relative to that allowed standard?
I don't know where the city of Umatilla obtains its drinking water supply, and I think we would have to try and find that out to see what that ratio is that they're dealing with before we can answer that.
Okay, I would like to know what that is in those wells that showed up the nitrate, how big of an area that was. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I'm not sure that I can enlighten you on where the city of Umatilla gets its water. But the question that I was having was your report of Marl picture and the kind of implication circles. And I'm having some difficulty in just seeing exactly what the photo is. Some circles, and therefore would lead me to think agriculture, and therefore would lead me to think that the implication here is an agricultural contamination in that area. Is that the picture that you're... that's just being portrayed here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, what we're trying to portray here is simply that in this area, one of the stakeholders that's been involved in the Umatilla plan was the port, and my understanding is they actually own some property that this property that is in an agricultural use and therefore could potentially be one of many contributors to a groundwater problem. But really the message from Umatilla is that this is a success story in the sense that all these folks are getting together to identify potential vulnerability of all these sources in terms of groundwater contamination, as they're all stepping up to the plate to bring solutions to that issue. So it's not meant to portray the port as the problem, it's one of the many stakeholders in that area.
Chair, if I could, I just need to make an observation or for the record, I guess, that agriculture frequently gets a lot of blame in some of these areas, and I know that in relationship to that area,
that these are the most probably carefully monitored farms in the country, that they're satellite monitored for both water and nutrients that go on. Very, very carefully done to a point that the only application is that which is needed for use as such. So I would just like every representative from that area, want to make my point that the farming, while it must share the load and everything that's going on, is probably not the principal source now of any contamination that is taking place there and maybe elsewhere.
Another tool that DEQ has to work with Oregonians on clean water is to provide financial assistance to communities. DEQ administers what is called the State Revolving Loan Fund, which is a low-interest loan that is capitalized under the Federal Clean Water Act. DEQ has provided over $300 million in low-interest loans to about 71 communities. To date, most of the funding helps to finance municipal treatment plants, such as the facility you see on the slide. However, both at the national level and here at DEQ, we'll be working over the next couple of years to broaden the eligibility of that loan program beyond just point sources, so that other non-point source activities can be eligible for these low-interest loans. I think Lang mentioned in his opening remarks another program that focuses on helping, in particular, small communities called the Environmental Partnership for Oregon Communities, or EPOC. DEQ has been working with these small communities to help them solve some of their environmental problems. One example that we're showing here is the city of Garibaldi. Garibaldi has been working with the EPOC program since 1994 and has been provided technical help and direction to help prioritize their environmental issues. The prioritization has allowed the city to focus first on its drinking water violation and to remove an underground storage tank that was causing some contamination of groundwater. Then, with funding provided by the Clean Water State Revolving Loan that I just mentioned, as well as a block grant obtained through the Oregon Economic Development Department, Garibaldi has begun to replace portions of its sewer system that are responsible for sewer overflows into Tillamook Bay. And this process will help them to eliminate those overflows into the bay by next year. DEQ also manages what is known as the Section 401 water quality certification process under the Clean Water Act. Federal agencies often permit or license activities in Oregon, and these permitted actions can and do have adverse impacts on Oregon's water quality if they're not properly managed. DEQ has the responsibility to review these activities, such as dredging and wetland fills, that are proposed by federal agencies, and then to assure that those projects meet state water quality standards. As an example, hydropower facilities that are regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have 50-year operating licenses that come up for renewal occasionally, and DEQ works with the Water Resource Department and ODF&W to review those hydropower facilities to make sure that once back in operation or once relicensed, that those facilities are managed to meet state water quality standards.
How large do those hydro facilities need to be before your license is managed? How many kilowatts of those? There's a little bitty one just up from Three Mile Dam on the Umatilla River. Is that...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I don't know the answer to that. I'll find out. To my understanding, I think any facility that would be required to get the FERC license would trigger a 401 certification on our part, and I'll verify that for you.
Thank you.
Do DEQ's role is to make sure that these projects, as I mentioned, meet state water quality standards. And this is important not only to ensure that the project itself is meeting our state water quality standards, but obviously it's an equity issue to make sure that the federal agencies are just as accountable for meeting state water quality standards as everyone else in the state. So this is an important process for us to make sure that as federal agencies get involved in the permitting and licensing process, that they're meeting our water quality standards and achieving the same goals that we're holding everybody else accountable for. I'd now like to turn this over to Rick Gates to talk about DEQ's monitoring and laboratory function.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Rick Gates. The Department's water quality monitoring efforts cover a wide range of activities that include physical, chemical, and biological aspects.
I'm sorry, can we go back? I lost focus here for just a second. Back to the previous section. On the 401 certification, we have so many disconnects on 401 certification. I'm not sure that there's any purpose to that process anymore. Though. Permits that were required on federal grazing plants in the state of Oregon on top of a NEPA process developed a tenure management plan. It seems to me that there's no useful purpose whatsoever. And currently we're not doing anything after four iterations of policy and procedure. And that system seems to have collapsed on itself. Why is the state certifying federal permits under the Clean Water Act? Why do we have to go through a loop at the federal level and then a concurrent loop at the state level, which includes no new information? As a matter of fact, there's a whole bunch of stuff at a lower level than the federal agencies do.
Mr. Chair, I think the heart of the issue is whether or not, in fact, the federal plans, whether it's a BLM plan or a Forest Service plan, when they are developed, whether or not they're actually developed to specifically meet state water quality standards. My own personal knowledge of at least some of the preliminary federal plans that we're looking at as to submit as TMDLs to delist some of the water quality limited streams that we have on the list, is that although they were very good plans, when you really got down to whether or not the implementation was targeted to meet state water quality standards rather than perhaps a goal or an objective that the federal agency might have set for itself in terms of natural resource management, was entirely sufficient to meet water quality standards. I look at this as if we can get to the point of having some good templates with the Forest Service and BLM at a planning level, then I think we can start to make sure that these plans are in fact meeting with state water quality standards, and I think that the certification will actually provide more legal assurance to both the federal agency and the landowners who operate under those plans. Because without a certification, I think it still begs the question, well, do these plans meet state water quality standards or not if the state is silent? And then I think you open up at least in theory, some liability to the landowner or the federal agency from a third-party lawsuit. So I agree with you that this whole area of non-point source certification was somewhat unique to the state of Oregon because of the Camp Creek decision. But that aside, I think that the benefit that has come from this discussion has been that we've been able to sit down with the Forest Service and BLM and be very specific about are their activities, once implemented under these federal plans, going to meet state water quality standards or not. I think that dialogue has been very, very helpful. I also agree with you, Mr. Chair, that we ought to get to the point of just certifying the plan rather than then having to certify each individual applicant that's operating under a plan, because I think that would be redundant. But as you are familiar with, I think that we're just in that evolution stage right now of getting the plans certifiable. But I agree, we don't want to create more paperwork and yet another process for the landowner to go through. If we can focus on the plans and the ultimate goal of the federal agencies, I think we can find a good solution there.
In fact, in those allotment management plans, which are a 10-year plan, we have a hydrologist fisheries biologists, wildlife biologists, soil scientists, and others that review the plan. So your contention is if we just focus them on the water quality question, as well as the management objective of the agency, we'd have a plan that would meet the state's water quality objectives without a further process.
Mr. Chair, I think that's the ultimate goal. I realize the federal agencies have much broader natural resource management issues that they have to take into consideration when they're developing these management plans for large landscapes. But our specific activity is to look at, once implemented, will these plans actually lead to attainment or preservation of the existing water quality standards in that area? And this is going to become extremely important as we start to get more and more into the TMDL arena on these complex watersheds. We have some federal land, some state land, private land, to make sure that the federal component of that overall watershed plan is just as rigorous in terms of being able to defend it as meeting our state water quality standards as a 10-10 plan or an NPDES permit that we issue.
Let me talk just a minute about the FERC's licensing process. Is DEQ the lead agency for commentary on FERC relicensing for hydroelectric facilities and others? Or is there a designated agency, the lead agency, for collating and characterizing and then forwarding comments on FERC licensing process?
Oh, my understanding is that there was a task force that was put together during the last session that included, I think the lead is actually the Water Resource Department, which includes both DEQ and ODS&W. Our focus within the 401 certification, obviously, is state water quality standards, but obviously with water rights or fisheries issues, all the agencies are involved in those discussions. We clearly have the lead, at least on the 401 certification, but in the project that I'm familiar with, we're very involved in discussing the state's comments with water resources if it relates to any type of a water right question, and particularly with the ODF&W as it relates to fisheries protection, so that we've got a coordinated approach.
And would DEQ submit its comments then to the Water Resources Department or directly to the permit project coordinator at the federal level?
Mr. Chair, I believe that, I don't know if there's a formal joint comment process. I'll have to verify that for you. I know that where we've got some major hydropower facility discussions right now, like on the North Umpqua, Powerdale facility is one that I'm familiar with, that there's basically a team of staff from the various agencies that are involved. But I think our correspondence related to 401 would come through us to FERC in terms of a process.
I guess what I'm concerned about is that it's conceivable that we could have agencies submitting commentary across purposes, even though they're supposed to coordinate under the lead of a single agency. And I wonder about the wisdom of sending mixed messages or sending messages through more than one channel, even if they're not mixed. Seems like a duplication of effort. If you have a task force supposed to concentrate the questions and issues relative to FERC processes under a lead agency, and then you're submitting stuff outside that process on your own letterhead. Mm-hmm. I just wonder about whether or not that is a duplication or leads to the possibility of mixed messages.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the whole intent of this task force was to avoid that and to formalize much more the working relationship with the state agencies. I just need to verify whether or not there's any formal communication that is going to FERC that's independent from either Water Resources or the FMW. If that's the case, so I'll verify that for you.
Mr. Messler and then Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to address another area where I think there's same concerns for all these discussions going on, and that is the soil removal permits. My understanding that the Division of State Lands issues a permit for the state with consultation with all the state departments, including you folks, DEQ and ODF&W and whoever else is involved.
the permittee also has to get a permit from authorized from the Corps of Engineers. And in that case, you folks also have to concur. Not advise you, but you have to concur with the Corps of Engineers. Do you ever get across purposes with the Division of State Lands and the permit through the Corps of Engineers? In other words, after consultation with your department, does the Division of State Lands issue a permit that then you deny at the Corps of Engineers level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messley, I'm not aware of any situation like that that's occurred. Certainly, we, again, try to coordinate with DSL given their role in fill and removal. But what triggers CDQ's involvement is the Corps permit. Anytime a federal agency has a permit or license, that's what triggers the 401 process. But I'm not personally aware of any cross purposes that we've had with DSL.
Mr. Chair, I believe that you have had cross purposes in some of the agriculture maintenance, dredging of drainage ditches, and where that exact is the incidence. And I think there maybe have been others as well, where they did get the Division of State Lands permit, and it was denied because of your non-concurrence.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messley, you're correct, Representative Messley. That situation did occur in several instances. And I think that several things have been done to try to avoid that happening in the future. One is to adopt something like what Mike was talking about a few minutes ago with the hydro facilities. It's more of a team approach when these things come up, so that the communication with both with the other state agencies and with the federal agencies, and there are usually more than one. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, for example, in the instance that you're thinking about, was an agency that communicated with us about a concern that led us to come up with a different result from DSL in that instance. And there was inadequate communication with DSL and the other agencies as a result. So one thing that has happened is the team approach. Another is that we have been able, as a result of actions taken by the last legislature, to add an additional staff person so that the workload problem, which led in part to the disconnect there, has been somewhat alleviated. We now have two folks like working on 401 certifications, and there was a fee package put together for that. So I would not rule out the possibility that this could happen again. I certainly hope not, but I think we've reduced that likelihood quite a bit.
Sure, if I could have a follow-up.
Thank you.
The Division of State Lands has developed a general permit that are for the maintenance, not for new construction, but for maintenance and those kind of systems. Is that working, and is the Corps of Engineers accepting that? I'm hearing some rumblings that the Corps of Engineers is not going along with that process, and so we really haven't gained a thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I don't know about that, but it's a valid question, and I'll put it into it. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, you mentioned one of the I believe, and I'm just wondering if that is any portion of the budget presentation by DEQ.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarno, yes. We have a policy package related to restoring five of our current positions, so we'll be discussing.
We proceed. Thank you for that little regression.
We maintain an ambient monitoring program on Oregon's rivers and streams. This statewide network entails 142 sites that are sampled every other month and analyzed for approximately 30 conventional parameters. These sites have been selected to represent all the major river systems and reflect integrated impact from both point source and non-point source activities. The resulting information is used to determine if the water body is meeting water quality standards, to identify trends for improving or declining or holding water quality standards, and to identify problem areas. A groundwater monitoring program is also maintained that includes both the initial groundwater assessment surveys and the long-term sampling in groundwater management areas such as the Lower Unitilla Basin and the Malheur Basin. Other monitoring activities include watershed assessments, TMDLs, toxics monitoring, permit compliance sample testing, and estuary monitoring in conjunction with the Department of Agriculture's shellfish sanitation program. Biological and habitat monitoring are conducted in smaller, wadable streams and cover vertebrate and invertebrate population and diversity assessments. That's fish and bugs to most people. Physical habitat assessments and water chemistry testing are also done in about 140 stream sites that are sampled every year. Current activities include best management practice effective monitoring in the Grand Ronde River Basin, baseline stream assessments in the Deschutes Basin and on the west slope of the Cascades, which are being done in conjunction with EPA's Regional Environmental Monitoring and Assessment Program. As part of the Oregon Plan, biomonitoring work is being conducted in the coastal, lower Columbia, and lower Willamette Valley Evolutionary Significant Units, or ESU. DEQ has worked as part of the interagency monitoring team for the Oregon Plan to coordinate these monitoring efforts with agencies such as the Oregon Department of Forestry, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, as well as other state and federal agencies.
Question? It's kind of a big hole in the middle of your map. On the left-hand side, where all the population is, and I just wondered why that's
Mr. Chair, our biomonitoring and habitat monitoring efforts are relatively new, and they have been sparked mostly by EPA federal grants, and we have just basically started in about 1998 to really get this program up and running, so we still have a number of void areas within the state.
Is the federal appropriation of grant money driving the selection of the areas?
Both the Oregon Plan and our federal REMAP grant are the primary efforts that have been driving this. We have been doing some in the Grand Ronde River Basin for a fairly long length of time, but the answer to the question is primarily yes.
Because I was going to say the Oregon Plan hasn't even discovered Southwest Oregon. Not an issue, and the major focus of the Oregon Plan will be the Willamette Basin. So
that's correct. We have not gotten funding to support that effort in the Willamette Basin at this time. Only in the lower Willamette.
Senator Tarno, I see you're enjoying the irony of this.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I think you had a real nerve. In light of the fact that the governor has got his Willamette River initiative out there, have you folks decided to maybe look at altering your focus?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarno, at such a time as we get some indication to go ahead and do that, we will certainly do that. At this point, it's been primarily the Coastal Coho that have been driving our efforts and the federal grant.
Person King. I'm sitting here just amazed that Tom for up there mentally doesn't have a list of questions.
Representative, don't encourage him.
Well, we only got 5 points in it.
I was noticing on the map just before, Ambient Monitoring Network, and showed hot spots that, you know, created the red spots of, you know, where the nitrogen was. But it looks to me like there's, you know, four sites that are way up in McKenzie, and one's almost like, you know, at the end of the line, and it's like some of the cleanest water we have in the state, and I'm wondering why there's so much concentration of monitoring there. And that, for example, so much of the Willamette Valley wasn't in the monitoring process, and when we had monitors in Cobra, that was a hot spot. We might have other hot spots. So why are we monitoring that really clean stuff up there?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I'm not sure I can answer. I think I see the one spot you're looking at on the McKenzie.
And the other three that are clustered are, you know, pretty far up there also. I wonder if they were correlated to dam sites, and if so, why they're not on the other.
One of the others is correlated to a dam site, and those three clusters provided one sampling point that is upstream from the confluence of those two rivers that you see, and the other is downstream to the confluence that you also see. Part of this sampling network has been established as a watershed council within McKinsey River Watershed Council that has asked us to move in there and set up permanent monitoring sites for that location. Volunteer monitoring through watershed councils, soil and water conservation districts, and other groups is a new and expanding element to the collection of water quality data. The department provides monitoring equipment, training, technical assistance, and data management for volunteer monitoring groups. Thus far, equipment training has been provided for over 34 such groups. DEQ also helps to develop a water quality monitoring guidebook for the watershed councils and other volunteers to help standardize monitoring activities and improve data quality. This recently completed guidebook will soon be available on GWES webpage. We have developed several indicators to compress large amounts of monitoring data into a more readily understood format. The Oregon Water Quality Index is a single number which expresses water quality by integrating measurements of the 8 water quality parameters shown on the screen. The index was developed to provide a simple yet valid means of expressing laboratory data in the assessment of water quality. It can be used to define water quality as good, fair, or poor, determine whether the water quality is improving, declining, or holding constant, and used for screening out problem areas that need a more detailed look at the actual testing data. While this is a very valuable water quality assessment tool, it is limited in its use to only reflect the impact of the 8 classical water quality parameters that went into its makeup. It does not include such things as toxic habitat or biological diversity, and as a result, it is possible to have seemingly conflicting signals such as good water quality chemistry, but poor biological diversity due to poor habitat. The Index of Biological Integrity is an indicator based on the health of the biological community. Factors like the diversity of species and the presence or absence of sensitive species are evaluated. For example, initial data from the Oregon Coast Range, collected as part of the Oregon Plan Monitoring Work, shows that approximately 60% of the wadable coastal streams have impaired macroinvertebrate communities, a key food source for salmon and trout. This information is combined with stream...
Can you define impaired?
The way we do comparisons on these studies, we look at reference sites that express what the potential of the stream is to be a good, healthy stream, and then we compare what the healthy communities are like to other sites in the stream to see how they match up to that.
Okay, so those are... We're not doing computer models or theoretical comparisons. You're actually doing site-specific observations, characterizing healthy community, and then making comparisons in the river to that standard.
That's correct. Okay. In order to fully understand where and how we use these indicators, one needs to gain a perspective of the size and relative distribution of Oregon's rivers and streams. River and stream segments are generally classed as first, second, third, fourth, or fifth order streams. The classification is based on the number of tributaries and branch tributaries that flow into a particular water segment. Although flow and size are not a factor in this classification, one can generally observe that a first-order stream is something you can literally step across. A second-order stream will likely cover your ankles as you walk across it. A third-order stream probably has water up to your knees or waist as you wade across it. A fourth-order stream will likely have you debating whether you can wade across it.
and you were probably swimming across the fifth order stream, being as they represent the lower reaches of the major rivers in Oregon. In viewing Oregon stream miles by stream order, it is easily seen that the majority of Oregon streams are the small first order streams, and that 92% of the streams are classed as first, second, and third order streams. Only 8% of Oregon's streams and rivers are classed as fourth or fifth order. Most of our ambient water quality network sites are located in these larger fourth and fifth order streams. These are lower down in the watershed, where there are integrated impacts from both point and non-point sources, and the issues center around overall water quality chemistry.
And that would be a wonderful place to stop for the day. Yeah, 5 minutes before we're in session. So, if there's any further business to come for the committee this morning, we are in adjournment.